Carnivores Don't Get Sunburn. Hosted by Carrie Mann. Dive into the extraordinary journey of rediscovering optimal health through the carnivore diet. Here, we share powerful transformations from reversing chronic illnesses to achieving peak human potential. Each episode, we'll explore the real stories of those who've turned their lives around, embracing a diet that's as natural as the sun. Stay tuned as we uncover the science, the success stories, and the secrets to thriving on this ancestral diet. Plus, don't miss our exciting documentary highlights featuring a diverse range of carnivore champions. Ready to challenge the conventional? Let's get started.
As a dentist, we're told we have to give nutritional counseling, but if you see what that is, you just throw your hands up in the air and be like, this is absolutely ridiculous. If everyone was eating a carnivore diet, like cavities would largely not exist. Periodontal disease largely wouldn't exist. So immediately when I started eating lots of red meat, which had basically been absent in my diet for the previous 30 years, the mental energy just came and I was feeling so good. 70% of people are overweight or obese. The evidence is hiding right under your nose. Our teeth tell us a lot about what we should and shouldn't be eating. You ever stop to wonder, we're the only animal whose teeth don't fit into their own heads? That's like, should be a showstopper. There is no reason. Getting a cavity on carnivore should be close to impossible. So the frequency of eating carbohydrates plays a big role, whether, you know, you are going to get a cavity or not.
Would we even need dentists if we were all eating a carnivore diet? Hello and welcome. Carrie here from Healing Humanity, the Power of a Proper Human Diet. And today I am thankful, grateful, and blessed to welcome Dr. Kevin Stock on the channel. Dr. Stock, how are you doing?
Good, Carrie. Excited to be here. Thanks for, you know, having me on. Excited to chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe before we jump in, I'm really interested in hearing sort of your personal carnivore story. But could you maybe share a little bit about your background and professional experience?
Sure. So my professional experience is I'm a dentist by trade. I focus in pediatrics. So I do pediatric dentistry, very part-time, and then a niche area of dentistry called dental sleep medicine, where that's the treatment of sleep disordered breathing. So things from snoring to obstructive sleep apnea.
Oh, I didn't know the second part. That is very interesting. I'll have more questions on that because one of the many things I cured on carnivore was sleep apnea and finally got to get rid of that stupid CPAP machine that I absolutely despised.
Excellent.
So could you maybe talk a little bit about like what led you to a carnivore diet?
Sure. And it's a long story. It kind of goes all the way back to, you know, childhood really, where I struggled with weight as a kid. I was an overweight kid. And really, I was pretty much hell-bent on figuring out like how to not be a fat kid. So that's where it started. And I did all the wrong things initially. And, you know, I was trying to do what people thought, you know, what you thought was right. You eat the healthy fats like the oils and, you know, the healthy carbs like the oats. And I ran cross country. And basically, I turned into like a stick figure on the other side, like no muscle. But that wasn't what I was looking for either. So through just years and years of experimentation, I started to figure out like what actually worked from a body composition standpoint. And I like to say that was kind of like the first half of the journey, the health and fitness journey. And that was really the fitness half. The health half came in the second half, where I kind of added health and fitness together because they're not mutually exclusive, but they're not like, they're not just because you have fitness doesn't mean you have health. And so I was struggling with various, like, I'll say health things. And the biggest thing was like mental energy and just, I was working on a lot of different projects. And so I'm sorry. I'm not sure if you can hear someone blowing leaves right next door, of course.
No, it's not. You're good.
Right, good. But I wanted to really, I wanted to feel better mentally. Like I was happy with how I looked, but I was like looking for mental energy. So I went back, I did a ketogenic diet because I'd done them previously, but I'd always cheated on them with too much protein for body composition reasons. And this time I was like, I was going to do it real strict and serious. And so I kind of limited protein and I didn't really get the mental health benefits that I was hoping for. And I lost a lot of muscle mass and I was like, okay, that's not what I wanted to do. And but that was the first kind of jumpstart into, I will say, carnivore, because I've really looked at my diet and I was like, all right, what are the things I've been eating? And it kind of boiled down to, like, it was a lot of chicken breast, a lot of vegetables. And then when it was keto, it was a lot of like olive oil and things like that. So I really just stripped things back and I was started eliminating various plant-based foods based on various research I was doing. And it got to the point where I was just eating meat. And this is back in 2017. I was just eating beef and started feeling fantastic. And I had written a lot about kind of my fitness journey for a long time. And so I was starting to write about like why I was just doing this weird diet. Kind of started off as a temporary thing, and now here we are, you know, over 7 years later.
Wow. So you kind of backed into it as opposed to me and like many others were, oh, we saw Dr. Sean Baker doing it kind of thing.
Yeah. So I was, what's interesting is Sean Baker was on Joe Rogan, I think towards the end of 2017. And the reason I remember that is because I started eating only meat that year. And at the end of the year, a friend texted me and said, hey, there's this doctor on Joe Rogan that's eating a diet just like you're doing. And I'll tell you what, that was really, I would say, comforting at that point. Not that I was like worried about like I was messing myself up or anything like that, but it was like, hey, there's some this other group of people that I didn't know that are like, hey, we're doing this too. So it kind of gave me more kind of confidence that I was at least going down the right path.
Right. Like I'm not alone. There's other people.
Exactly.
That's been one really amazing thing for me on carnivore too. I knew there were other people doing it, obviously, because there's Dr. Baker and some of these others, but I thought I was much more isolated until I started doing it more and realizing like there's actually a lot of people eating this way. Even older people. I get so many people on my channel, 60s, 70s, 80s that are doing this and just thriving for a couple of years. It's kind of amazing. So when you kind of backed into more carnivore, what were some things you noticed? Was there anything with brain fog or your mental health that changed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So immediately when I started eating lots of red meat, which had basically been absent in my diet for, you know, the previous 30 years, kind of like the mental energy just came and I was feeling so good. And so I noticed that, which overcame the downsides of the first, I will say, few weeks of GI distress. And that is even, I'd come from keto. So it wasn't just fat adaptations, but it was a lot of, I think, like the microbiome and lack of fiber. So I was having like GI, like was not great, but I was like, I feel so good. I'm going to keep pushing through this. And so I kept on keeping on. And then a few more weeks later, my kind of gym performance kind of came back because there was a while where I was like, I'm not really performing as well in the gym, but I'm feeling good. So keep on keeping on. So those were kind of like the initial main things that I noticed were like, my main objective was like, hey, I got this energy. I've been feel like I was lacking and like just mental clarity. And I could work from start to the day, the end of the day, and I don't need to rely on coffee. And then the GI stuff settled itself out. And then the gym stuff, I started putting back on muscle that I'd lost previously. And yeah, kind of the rest is history from there.
Was there like a turning point during your journey where you're like, this is it. Like I'm doing this now. This is kind of crazy what's happening.
I will say you brought up the podcast with Dr. Sean Baker. I'll say that was a turning point because I've always been kind of just an experimental diet. I mean, I've been doing weird diets for, you know, over two decades. So it was just kind of another Kevin being a weird kind of experiment. But I'll say him being on Joe Rogan and the community that followed on the back end of that led into 2018, where it was the first full year. I was like, this whole year, I'm just going to do just beef only and let's just see what happens. So where I just really committed to it more of a long term for a year, where without that community aspect, I probably would have been like, hey, let me see now what plants can I add back in and still do good with, which I think is a fine approach for most people. But I probably would have not have been as strict carnivore as long as I have been if it wasn't for, I'll say, that just massive community and kind of more of like, once I started doing it, there's a lot of pushback. Like, hey, this is stupid for XYZ reasons. And more of less is like, hey, I'm going to kind of like prove this out to myself. Like I'm going to use myself as a guinea pig and experiment and I'm going to research and write about it. And, you know, that's what I've done.
And what sort of changes did you notice? I know you said there was a little bit of a lull in the gym. Are you doing mostly like weightlifting or cardio or a little bit of everything?
More just kind of, you know, meathead in the gym, bodybuilding type workouts, So yeah, we dive more into that, but yeah, just gym weightlifting kind of stuff.
Right. You mentioned that you've done all sorts of different diets. I can relate to that. I remember when I started carnivore, people are like, here he goes again. Another crazy fad diet he's doing. Did you get that from anyone? Like, here you go, this is a fad diet. And do you consider carnivore kind of different from those other diets in any way?
I will. So I guess I was kind of more in a unique situation than most people in that I really had been doing weird diets since junior high and high school. So my family, friends, immediate circle are just like, it's just like, no questions asked really, like, oh, maybe like, well, why and things like that. But no, like no struggles or anything like that with like social situations, where I know for a lot of people, that is a big barrier, like family, friends, social gatherings, things like that. So it was not, you know, it wasn't like a shock to, I'll say, the social circles or anything like that.
Right. Yeah. My thing, I didn't realize early on, but later when I tell people, I'm like, carnivore for me just seems like the most natural thing, where all those other weird diets I tried before, they always seem sort of forced and like, I just got to do this for a couple of weeks and get through this. And then I can go back to whatever I was doing before. But for me, carnivore seems like the closest I can get to what's probably natural for humans, and makes more sense for me that way, I guess.
Well, I would say I agree with that. So the better half of the last decade, I've kind of spent, so if we break up this journey into health and fitness, the first half I would research, you know, I got my degree in chemistry and I did a minor in biology. And it was also, I was filtering the sciences through how to build muscle and lose fat. Well, for the last 10 years or so, you know, I went through dental school, and after that, really just tons of independent research about what our teeth say we should eat and how it actually just, the evidence is hiding right under your nose, more or less, that, you know, our teeth tell us a lot about what we should and shouldn't be eating. And so I've done just a tremendous amount of research in the area of how the mouth tells us what we should be eating. And all evidence points to a heavy meat-based diet.
Quick interruption. Did you know we have an incredible membership site for you called healinghumanity.life? We have a special offer going on right now. Learn more at the link in the description. We have courses. We have expert Q&As with the good doctors. We even have a Healing Humanity Heroes Zoom call once a week, highlighting real heroes that will inspire you on a path to healing. The community is wonderful. We're going to be implementing a buddy system so you can be held accountable, recipes, all sorts of great stuff to help you on a path to healing. Learn more at the link in the description below.
I've heard you talk about this before, and it's so fascinating. It's so interesting when you start digging into some of this some more. Could you talk about it a little bit more? Like here's a question. Would we even need dentists if we were all eating a carnivore diet?
We would need a dentist in acute situations, meaning like someone punches you in the face and you got a broken tooth and, you know, you go to a dentist to fix that. But if everyone's eating a carnivore diet, like cavities would largely not exist. Periodontal disease largely wouldn't exist. For those wondering, cavities are the most common disease in the world. Periodontal disease, 50% of U.S. adults have periodontal disease. By the time you're 65 years old, 70%+ of U.S. adults have periodontal disease. So, I mean, these are some of the most common prevalent diseases in the world that largely wouldn't exist if we're only eating meat, because, I mean, carbohydrates are the main kind of cause of these issues. But we would need dentists in acute care situations. And I would even argue it would be unlikely we would even need orthodontics. So a lot of malocclusion is a result of improper human diets, I would argue. And I believe the, you know, the evidence both in the archaeology and really just like the anthropologic record bears that out.
So when you say that, is that like braces and kind of our jawlines changing over time?
Yeah. So almost everyone, it's like a rite of passage these days for, you know, you turn 18 or, you know, your late teens and you just got to get wisdom teeth out. And you ever stop to wonder, like, we're the only animal whose teeth don't fit into their own heads? Like that's like, should be a showstopper. Like, hey, what's going on here? And then malocclusion as well. So if you look in like the archaeologic record up until basically the Industrial Revolution, let's say the 1700s, you look at all these fossils prior to that, and there was like, you didn't have all these malocclusions, like crooked teeth, right? So the problem is today, that started with the Industrial Revolution, our jaws have gotten smaller. And so the teeth have not shrunk, though. So they're just trying to fit wherever they can. It leads to malocclusion. But a lot of people just blame it on genetics. And I believe there is definitely an epigenetic component to it. But in evolutionary timescales, your genes just don't change that much in, you know, a few hundred years, nonetheless, a few thousand years.
Right. It's so fascinating. Like, a lot of what you're saying is also true for just general healthcare. Like, I don't even know if we would need many doctors other than for acute reasons or I break my leg or something if we were all eating a proper human diet.
Right. And you could argue, like, the healthcare system is actually, you know, great at treating some of these kind of acute conditions, but it's just woeful at treating chronic conditions. And why is that? Because, like, the root cause of these chronic conditions, of so many of them, is our diet. And basically, healthcare doesn't even touch diet. Like, as a dentist, we're told we have to give nutritional counseling. But if you see what that is, you just throw your hands up in the air and be like, this is absolutely ridiculous. And same thing is on the medical MD side. Like, you know, they don't know anything about nutrition either. So, like, the root cause of these chronic diseases, no one's even touching them. And I would argue, like, those that are supposed to, like the dietitians and such, the training and education they got is so, I'll just say it's like, it seems like special interest has created a lot of those curriculums.
Right, right. It's really interesting when you start to think about the overall cost to humanity of eating improper foods. Like, when you think about just the dental side of it too, I never even really thought about that, but all of the braces, all of the cavities, all of the checkups going in over and over again for years and years.
Yeah. Like, the dental profession would be just tiny. I talk about that all the time. It's like, we largely wouldn't exist if we were eating, I would say, a human appropriate diet. Because if you think about it, cavities for wild animals, for example, like, very rare in wild. It does happen in small amounts in certain circumstances. But generally, a species eating its proper diet, it shouldn't rot the teeth that is eating that food. Like, that is, like, very incongruent in evolutionary time. Like, the food you eat, like, your mouth and your teeth play a very important role in, you know, eating food, which arguably that's what evolution selects for more than anything else. And so, you know, the fact that your diet would rot your teeth just is massive incongruence and should cause cognitive dissonance if someone is advocating a diet that rots your teeth, because that doesn't make any sense.
Right. It's like you start to have these sort of carnivore epiphanies, or you take a step back and you're like, some of this stuff is just really crazy. The fact that we're sort of slowly poisoning ourselves or ingesting foods that are causing us to have all of these procedures. You mentioned a little bit earlier the thing with me, I had sleep apnea and CPAP machine. And in retrospect, I stopped snoring like right away on carnivore. I heard Jordan Peterson on Joe Rogan say he stopped snoring on week one. And I'm down 100 pounds since my heaviest. And my sleep doctor told me, like, I went in for a legit sleep study. He's like, you're just big. You got to lose some weight before you'll stop snoring. But I didn't lose a pound and I stopped snoring. It's from inflammation. My point is, though, it's crazy to me in retrospect. I'm like, I used to have to go through this elaborate process, put this mask with this hose on and strap it to my face, all so that I could continue to ingest foods that were causing that to happen. Like, what is going on here? And it's like similar with some of this other stuff with the dental stuff. Like, my daughter has braces. I've had so many dental procedures, cavities and root canals and all sorts of horrible things that would have been completely unnecessary. It's really crazy when you think about the cost of it all.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting that, I like to talk to people that have gone down kind of the sleep testing route, sleep health, CPAP route. I'm not sure if you're familiar, like, dentists can treat obstructive sleep apnea as well with these oral devices. And they're custom made devices that will hold the jaw in a position that opens up the airway. Like, if you're ever taught CPR, they'll tell you to lift the jaw to open the airway.
Okay.
So by moving the jaw up, it takes the tongue with it and helps open the airway. So that's, I have a private practice out of dental school. I started no patients, nothing. Just all I was doing was dental sleep medicine and trying to get sleep physicians to refer me patients, because about half of people prescribed a CPAP cannot or will not wear it. And so those sleep doctors would be like, well, we got to do something. So they would send them to myself or other dentists that have, like, advanced training in this area. And we make these devices. But the devices I was making they were good. There's good things about them, and they do work, and they treat various populations. But there's also struggles with them as well. So the fact that you're able just to, like, fix it with diet is, you know, fantastic. Because people would argue, like, doctors would say, that's impossible. You're not going to fix sleep apnea with diet. But, you know, you lose the fat, you get rid of the inflammation, it opens the airway. start sleeping with your mouth shut, tongue in the proper position, and sure enough, you can breathe throughout the night.
Yeah, it's crazy. I had a sleep doctor on my channel a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about, he was getting deep into the math, but he's like, if you take like a cylindrical tube and then you calculate just going from this to this, the amount of volume that goes through it is crazy. So he's like, just even a little inflammation could trigger that snoring. The thing with me is I suffered from just horrible depression, anxiety. And throughout the years, whenever my sleep would improve, which was very rare, I was always snoring, but every now and then I get a really good night's sleep. The subsequent days, I'm like, I'm not as anxious. I feel better. Like there's definitely a tie in between sleep and depression, anxiety, mood, hormones, whatever it may be. So to be able to fix something like that with a dental procedure, CPAP machine, or nutrition, I think is so huge. I think there's a lot of people that are just like, oh, that's too bad. I snore. Like I'm not sleeping as good as I can, but they don't necessarily realize the downstream effects. Once my sleep improved, the mood improved, the depression, anxiety started going away. I feel like my immune system got stronger. There's like so many things that go into that sleep. But
one of the most shocking things when I started the practice, I was just this naive, 26-year-old kid. It's like, I'm going to start treating sleep apnea. And so, I'm seeing my first patients and you take a health history. Like I knew what I was doing, but I was green in the sense that everyone is on antidepressants. I was like almost every patient I saw was on antidepressants, and I'm looking up. So I go to like research and I'm like, what is the prevalence of depression and how many people are on are on these medications? And it is, first of all, a very high percentage of people that are on them, and an extraordinarily high if you have sleep apnea, untreated sleep apnea. But when you start sleeping right, like you said, it changes people's lives. For one, for sleep apnea, people tend to go 5 to 10 years before they get a diagnosis and treated. So that's almost a decade of like not sleeping, like basically sleep deprived for a decade. And you give them a procedure or, something where they can actually get a good night's sleep, it like is life changing overnight. I don't know if you experienced that with your CPAP, because a lot of people hate CPAP. Like it's, like you said, it's a mask and a hose, but they're like, look, this thing is saving my life, so I'm going to put up with this. And so I just think it's fantastic that, you got treated and things like that, but even more fantastic that you can, by diet alone, you can get rid of the mask and have the sleep and, help all the various hormones where you actually feel good and are happy and, can enjoy life.
Right. Yeah. It was incredible to me just how quickly that happened. And then like you had the reassurance of Dr. Baker talking about carnivore. I had Dr. Jordan Peterson on Joe Rogan with the exact same, like he literally said on Joe Rogan, I stopped snoring the first week. And this was when I was still in research mode about carnivore, but I'm like, that's crazy. Like, I don't even know if I believe that, but since I've been doing my own YouTube videos, I've had so many people say the same thing. They stop snoring when they do carnivore, they get rid of that inflammation. Yeah, it's amazing. It's life-changing. The CPAP machine definitely did help me, but I hated it so much. Like I couldn't toss and turn or anything like that. It was an improvement, but this is definitely way better. So that's so interesting too about the sleep apnea and the prevalence of depression, anxiety. I guess it makes sense.
I mean, if you don't sleep, just go a couple nights of bad sleep and I'm like, I'll be irritable as can be. Imagine going years upon years like that. It's almost like if you weren't depressed, there'd be something wrong with you.
Yeah. And then the downstream effects that we may not realize, but all of a sudden I'm sick or I got a cold because my immune system's weaker because I'm not like fully regenerating at night, sort of thing.
Yeah. The sleep apnea research is very clear. Like if you have susceptibility to any kind of problem, sleep apnea is going to exacerbate it. Like if you have a little bit of high blood pressure, you're going to have uncontrollable high blood pressure. Diabetes, it's going to make your diabetes worse. Heart disease, it's probably going to oftentimes is like, hey, because like when you have sleep apnea, the heart, basically, if people that don't know, like the airway's closing down when you're sleeping and the body doesn't want you to die when you're asleep. So it'll pump like a cocktail of stress hormones to kind of subconsciously wake you up, open the airway. But that stress response all night long, is responsible for perhaps a lot of people dying in their sleep.
That was almost true in my case. It's interesting you said that. I didn't really think about this for a while, but one of my many issues was I suffered a TIA mini stroke about 8 years ago. And I got dizzy. Like my face was numb. I went to the hospital. I was there for like 5 days in the stroke unit. They did all these tests on me and they diagnosed me with congestive heart failure. They said your ejection fraction's 44. And just like you said, they're like, you got sleep apnea. It's probably really hard on your heart for those reasons. Cause they're like, this guy in his 30s, what is going on? I got all these health issues plus that. So yeah, definitely tied into it. Interestingly, 1 year on Carnivore, I went in and I had my heart echo done because I'm like, I feel like I could run a marathon now. I could barely stand up before. My ejection fraction was 44 before. It's 65 after 1 year on Carnivore. It's perfectly normal on Carnivore. And like, people, I tell people this and they think I'm lying, and I've shown my medical records on my YouTube channel. Anyone that wants to see them, they're open on several of my videos. Besides the congestive heart failure, I had a lifelong irregular heartbeat since birth. Like highly erratic heartbeat. I wore those Holter monitors throughout high school, middle school. I remember in kindergarten, I had to put this big vest down before they had the big technology. Always had irregular heartbeat, perfectly normal after 1 year on carnivore. After 43 years, I'm like, some of this stuff, I don't want to tell people because they think I'm making it up or something. It's all in my medical records. It's crazy. We interviewed Dr. Philip Ovadia for our documentary, and he was saying the heart performs much more efficiently while in ketosis. Plus, I don't have all that inflammation. Plus, I'm getting more electrolytes and things like that may be contributing to it. Plus, I lost a bunch of weight. So there's a lot of things going into it. But it's crazy some of the healing that you hear on eating this way.
For sure.
Yeah. So in terms of the dental stuff, it's like one other thing I've noticed personally is I don't have any issues. I always sound like I'm hyping up carnivore, but my teeth were always hurting. I'd have bloody gums. I'd always have toothaches and things like that. And I'm coming up on 600 days carnivore. I haven't been doing it for years and years yet, but like nothing, like noticeably nothing, where just before that I was always having these issues. Do you have any thoughts on that? Or is that something you see with others?
Yeah. So, and this is not just me like with a tinfoil hat or anything like that, because it's widely known and accepted among the dental professions, and your dentist likely knows this, is like the way you get a cavity is bacteria in your mouth ferment carbohydrates into acids. And there's more complicated aspects to all this. We can dive into more of the pathogenesis, but the necessary substrate is carbohydrate. Like if you don't have carbohydrate, the bacteria in your mouth, like strep mutans, has nothing to ferment and turn into acid. And like there's nothing to cause a cavity. And so when people are like, do I have to brush my teeth? Like when I'm doing carnivore, I still recommend it for various reasons, but I'm like, there is no reason that you should like, getting a cavity on carnivore should be close to impossible. And there's a few exceptions if you're like mouth breathing and like certain like exceptions out there. But in general, it's like, you know, you like the actual cause of cavities, since you're not eating it, is like, you're not going to get any cavities. And it's a similar story with periodontal disease. The pathogenesis is a little bit different, but it's same kind of story where, you know, you have bacteria in your mouth wreaking havoc, but those bacteria need to be fed the right thing in order to wreak that habit. And that's your diet. And if you're just eating meat or mostly meat and really a human appropriate diet, you should not have cavities, you should not have periodontal disease, which are two of like the main issues in dentistry beyond malocclusion, which you could argue is not necessarily pathology because it's so common, but I would argue it's not normal. It's common, but not normal. We shouldn't have malocclusion, but it's like 9 in 10 people do.
Yeah. So, obviously, I've always known sugar causes cavities, but when you say carbohydrates, is that like grains, breads, rice, stuff like that as well that could contribute to it?
Absolutely. So from kind of an anthropologic perspective, if we go back to, I'll just try and simplify this all. Prior to the agricultural revolution was about 10,000 years ago. Prior to that, cavities are rare in the fossil record. But 10,000 years ago, with the agricultural revolution, we start cultivating crops and as things like wheat and barley. And you know what we see at that time? Dramatic rise in cavities in the fossil record. And so, yes, even these like healthy whole grains, like even like grown in the most primitive conditions, like they were doing in the agricultural revolution, these were not GMO crops. Nothing special about these, besides the fact that, you know, humans were cultivating crops for the first time. We see a dramatic rise in cavities at that time. Now, fast forward to the Industrial Revolution, like we mentioned, 1700s or so, the rise in cavities starts to take off. And like today, it's ubiquitous. So not all carbohydrates are created equal. Like a sticky, refined sugar is going to be more cariogenic, like cavity causing, than, let's say, white rice, which is a little bit less cariogenic. But that's nonetheless, carbohydrates that are fermentable will and can cause cavities, but it has a lot to do with what they are. Like if they're highly refined and there's a lot of surface area and the bacteria can really ferment them into acids. And then secondarily, also how frequently they're consumed. So if you consume like a bunch of sugar, I like to use like a soda as a good example here, because it's one, it's already acidic because there's often phosphoric acid in it. Two, it's loaded with sugar, which is going to be fermented into acid. Three, it doesn't stimulate, you don't chew, so you don't stimulate saliva. And so this is a good example of like perfect cavity causing, you know, food, right. Like these soda drinks. But it's better if you drink a soda all at once, because you'll have one big acid attack, the body will recover, saliva will start remineralizing it. It'll take some time, 20 minutes or so. But if you sip on that soda throughout the day, the acid attack continues throughout the day. So the frequency of eating carbohydrates plays a big role, whether, you know, you are going to get a cavity or not. So if someone's eating like one meal with carbohydrates in it per day, very different than someone who's snacking on carbohydrates throughout the day.
Interesting. Yeah, I love how you do the quotes. I do that a lot when I talk about food nowadays. Food. What is it? So one question I had for you was, I did keto and then I did carnivore, and I get a lot of people that'll tell me, Gary, you would have just done the same thing if you just eliminated the sugar and the junk food. And I believe that's a big part of the puzzle, but I don't think it's all of the puzzle. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like if you just ate meat and still had low carb veg, you'd been just fine.
Yeah. I mean, I think a ketogenic diet is a fantastic diet for a lot of people. However, the reason I like carnivore more, and even like, I don't like the word animal based, but we could talk about that. Is, for example, you can do a ketogenic diet where you drink soybean oil for 70% of your calories, right? And then, you know, the other 30%, you're getting some, you know, pea protein. Now, by definition of ketogenic diet, you're going to be in ketosis and, you know, you got your right macros, but I would not eat either of those foods, right? So that is, that's one way, like ketogenic doesn't necessarily, it tells you about macros, but not about food quality. And I think food quality is more important, and especially foods that are congruent with human design. And so, for example, the soybean oil, yeah, it's fat. And I think fat is good, but that kind of fat isn't good. And I think tallow is good fat. And we can talk about like differences and why. But yeah, so I think there's a big difference in just keto versus carnivore. And while carnivore is often keto, because you're often going to be in ketosis if you're carnivore, keto is not carnivore often. So that's why people came up with the word as keto AF. I think Amber O'Hearn kind of, and that was keto animal foods is what the original kind of lingo. People now think it's keto, you know, AF, you know, you can extrapolate those words, but originally right. It was keto animal food. So it's like basically carnivore.
Right. Yeah. That's usually, I have a similar argument back to people. And the other thing is, I feel like getting the fatty meat was something my body was missing. I almost feel like I was deficient in cholesterol. I don't know. I'm just an individual. I'm not a doctor, but I feel like when I ate that fatty meat, my body was just like, yes, like you finally figured it out. Like this is what I needed. And everything seemed to improve from there.
100%. Like that's what, like the other side of the coin was like, not only the bad foods of keto, but you're not necessarily eating the good foods, which provide the kind of fat that we want, not just, you know, fat, but the good kind of fat, as well as various vitamins, minerals that you're only going to be getting in animal products. And so if you're not keto AF, a lot of times keto can get you results, and or you'll get stalled and or just not feel as good as you could or should if you were, I would say, eating more ancestrally human kind of appropriate, which I'm big on. And I know there's a pushback I get is like a naturalistic fallacy where it's like, if it's natural, then it's healthy, which is not what I'm saying. Obviously, there's natural foods like plants that are natural foods that aren't healthy. I just think my main argument is our health is so out of, like, so far from what it should be, is we should go back to first principles. And what is first principles is would be eating in accordance with our design. Well, how do we know what that is? Well, we can look back through anthropology and we can look at anatomy and physiology, and we can infer what our ancestors ate when they had healthy mouths. And we can see what happened at the turn of the agricultural revolution, industrial revolution, and at the information age, and what food inventions came about during these times and how that impacted our oral health and physical health. And by starting with these first principles, that's at least like a place we should start. And then if you want to add various food inventions on top of that, that's fine. But then the burden of proof is on you to like conclude if that is a healthy food. Like, right. The burden of proof is on seed oils to prove they're healthy. It's not on the burden of proof of, you know, animal fat that we've been eating for literally humans have been eating for millions of years. The burden of proof is on this novel fat that you created 100 years ago.
Right. Yeah. Doing this whole journey, I've had these like realizations or carnivore epiphanies. And one of them was when I first started, I'm like, Dr. Baker, Dr. Barry, these guys are talking about eating meat. And they're talking about fixing your metabolic health, mitochondria. Some of this stuff's going over my head. But what I realized later was basically what I'm doing eating carnivore, I believe, is eating as natural as humans can eat, given the options we have with 60,000 products in the grocery store. And some people argue, well, what about vegetables? And I have been learning more and more arguments against vegetables. I know Dr. Chafee talks about plants are trying to kill you. There's plant toxins. But you mentioned this a little bit with the mouth. There's bacteria in your mouth that's important. There's bacteria in your gut that's important. I started going down this rabbit hole recently. I don't know if you've been down it or not, but gut bacteria, gut biome. And I had a woman on my channel, and she basically said, we know basically about 4% of what's going on. Wait, look, we know nothing about it. It's like the brain. It's like the ocean. We know very little about what's going on there. But that was an area that I started going down more. But given the options, like with plants, my worry with plants are there's toxins in there as defense mechanisms. There's pesticides that we sprinkle some water on and we're like, oh, it's just fine now, even though those pesticides have permeated inside the vegetables. And the other big one that I've learned about more lately was glyphosate. And the fact that it's like everywhere now, it's in all the air we breathe, it's in the water. And the thing that like really blew my mind, this was just recently I learned this, that if you Google, anyone watching this can Google it themselves. I'm not a doctor, I'm not an expert, do your own research, but glyphosate's an antibiotic. So it's like humans are ingesting low levels, it's small dosages of antibiotics for years and years, decades and decades. It's like, every time you eat a bowl of cereal, you're eating glyphosate. A lot of these pesticides and plants have it on there. And I'm like, when I was learning more about the gut health and how volatile that can be, like you can have sugar, it could just refeed and regrow some bad bacteria and things like that. I'm like, what would it be doing to our guts if we're just ingesting these low levels of antibiotics for years and years, decades and decades? It can't be good.
No, 100%. And you phrased it, there's a bunch there, but you phrased some things really like great there. And like, with the available options that we have today, like a very heavy meat-based diet is like the best thing you can do. Because like you mentioned, even these other natural foods, first of all, many of them are not very natural. You can just look up the history of broccoli, right? And you can see how that was specially bred to become, you know, a very popular health food, but like that food largely didn't exist, you know, more than 100, 150 years ago. So it's not a part of our ancestral diet whatsoever. So any health benefits or claims, like, again, the burden of proof is on them to make that, because like introducing a brand new food to a human species is like, all right, maybe it's okay, but probably not. And yeah, the way you word that was fantastic. And to the biome. Yeah. So the oral biome, like your gut biome starts in the mouth, basically, right? This is like, think about it, one big tube, your mouth to anus, and right, the bacteria in the mouth and the gut kind of make up this microbiome. And like, we know, no one takes an antibiotic prophylactically. Like, you're not waking up with your daily morning vitamins and throwing an antibiotic in there because you're going to want to kill out your gut microbes, because we know it's important, right? And in the mouth, we like you said, like, how much do we actually know? But we know some about the bacteria in our mouth. And we have these bacteria that play a very important role in the mouth that produce nitric oxide. And nitric oxide plays a very important role in vascular health, notably vasodilation. So people that use antiseptic mouthwashes to kill the bacteria off in their mouth, they often will see an acute rise in blood pressure. And so it makes sense. You kill these bacteria off, they're responsible for dilating the blood vessels. Now you don't have that nitric oxide, so you don't get the vasodilation, you have vasoconstriction, you have increased blood pressure. So body is a very complex mechanism. There's so much that there's more that we don't know than we do. And that kind of is one of the arguments for going back to first principles and why I'm so keen with like ancestral diets and eating ancestrally appropriate, as kind of the human species would have eaten and our genes are kind of geared up to eat.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm hoping there's more research that comes out on the gut bacteria, gut biome, because it's, you know, like we were talking about, there's a little bit known, but I know they've been, like Hippocrates said thousands of years ago, all disease begins in the gut. And there's a lot of evidence now too, like with the gut brain axis and depression, serotonin, stuff like that, starting in the gut versus in the brain, which is so interesting. But I, on the vegetable side, I was talking to someone, I'm like, I'm trying to just calculate out the potential cons of eating like broccoli or kale, for example. And plant toxins are one, possible pesticide residue, possible glyphosate. Even if you buy organic kale, I was reading this, they did a study and 60% of organic kale studied had glyphosate on it. So you're ingesting glyphosate. And then the other big one that I learned recently is so much of the produce we have nowadays is so nutrient deficient because the soil is just like nothing left in the soil. 50 years ago, the soil was rich with nutrients and minerals, and you'd put some kale in there, you get some good healthy kale. Now you're putting it in, you're just blasting it with chemicals to get it to go. And then the last thing in my mind is like the amount of energy it takes the human digestive system to process that roughage. It seems like it's a lot more. Like, I used to struggle so much. I'm like, I'm eating a healthy salad and I had all these IBS issues and my stomach was always gurgling. It's like the amount of energy it takes, just that alone, everything else, ignore everything else I say, but the amount of energy it takes to process that, what am I getting out of the kale? Is it negligible at best, harmful at worst? Am I just like, I can tolerate it, so I should just do it because I can kind of tolerate a thing? Dr. Barry's awesome, and he advocates for a proper human diet. It's a spectrum, and you can have some low-carb veg, but I wanted to ask him that question. Like, are we just saying that because it's tolerable, or is it actually beneficial? Like, I don't know anymore. I think 50 years ago, it would have been different. You might've had like a real nutrient rich vegetable or something you're eating, but.
Yeah. There's a couple things. I'd probably push back against Dr. Ken Berry's statement regarding the low carb vegetables. Dr. Bill Schindler wrote this book, Eat Like a Human, I believe it's called. Great book. You read that book and you realize what you just said. So he talks about all these processes basically that humans kind of invented since the agricultural revolution to make eating plant-based foods possible, right? Detoxifying them and doing all these wild things so that we can make plants more, you know, one that we can tolerate and detoxify them and get some energy nutrition out of them. And so that's a great book where it's like, yeah, you can eat all these things. But like you mentioned, like there's a lot of work and energy that goes to preparing things properly to making them as good as possible. And is it how good is it versus just the effort goes into it? And is it also causing potential some harm because of how they're like the availability of these things today is a great point. One thing I would push back that I want to mention about Dr. Ken Berry, and kind of just this is like my study of anthropology, is, and I don't want to go too deep off, a cliff here of a tangent, but if you think ancestrally speaking, our ancestors are not looking out for low carb vegetables, right? The hunter gatherer ancestors are not going to be like, I'm going to eat that lettuce, that leaf, because it's not, doesn't give a lot of calories. They're doing the exact opposite. They are looking for the most nutrient, calorie dense foods possible. They're not concerned about getting fat or losing weight or getting metabolically healthy. Literally, they're seeking out the most like nutrient, caloric, energy dense foods. And so from early hominins like Homo habilis, who started eating more meat, to Homo erectus, who was a hyper carnivore, to Homo sapien, we see really Homo sapien, and this is, there's a lot of backstory to this, but Homo sapiens invented technologies to catch smaller, faster animals and process plants. And the plants that they're processing are not leafy greens. They're likely underground storage organs where there's actually some nutrition that can be gotten out of that. So you dig them up and it's like a potato, for example, there's like actual nutrition. You're going to get at least some calories out of that versus like eating leaves where you're not getting anything. So I think it's more human and ancestrally appropriate to actually like eat roots and fruits. And that there, I'm sure people would argue that, but humans would have eaten small amounts of fruits seasonally as they were available over various, you know, eons, but it would never been a major part of the diet since Homo erectus. And with Homo sapien, we see increase in salivary amylase gene, AMY1. And we see increasing copies of this gene as starches became more necessary to complement the diet as we decimated large animals. So there's a lot there that I'm kind of leaving out, but the broad strokes is I actually think underground storage organs are more ancestrally appropriate than any of these nutrient devoid, low calorie vegetable foods. Not saying that no one should eat those, and they're probably better for those that are metabolically like unhealthy and overweight because they'll just fill your gut up and you won't eat as many donuts, for example. But I wouldn't say they're like evolutionary appropriate or necessarily a necessary part of anyone's diet. I would personally eat fruits and roots or before I would eat broccoli and spinach and kale. Like, so that's how I think about things. I just wanted to, you know, give a different perspective there.
No, I appreciate it. I think I'm on the same page with you. I almost wonder if some of those recommendations are just sort of like, hey, people aren't going to jump into a carnivore diet. This is a way to ease them into it. So you can do a couple here or there. And maybe that's true because I know a lot of people that they do that and then they're like, man, I feel so much better. And they back themselves away from some of those things and end up just doing carnivore. But I don't know. Others may not. Others may be led down a wrong path then where I can't sustain this. I can't do it sort of thing.
Yeah. And so I think like the animal-based diet, which, you know, Paul Saladino's kind of, championed, I'll say it's slightly more evolutionary appropriate, but the quantity of fruit I think he backs off his recommendations. Like he eats a lot of fruit, but he's like, not necessarily everyone should eat that amount of fruit. And I'm like, if you're eating fruit that is grown locally, seasonally where you live and that's it. And I would say, you know, that's more or less fine. But huge amounts of fruit is not, I don't think, evolutionary consistent. And huge amounts of kale, spinach, these leaves and stems that really don't pack much nutrition or calories are just, like you said, if it makes you feel comfortable, which is like what Dr. Ken Barrage probably, it makes you feel comfortable to eat a steak if you have a couple pieces of lettuce of a salad next to it. But I just don't think it's, I really don't think it's really evolutionary, consistent.
Right. Well, you mentioned too, fruit out of season. I think that's one of the insane things going on in the world right now. People just eating fruit out of season multiple times a day because it's just so good for you. You got to do it. And there's a lot of science I've been learning more lately about how the body processes fruit out of season versus in season. There's like a lot of really interesting things that happen there. But it's so interesting when you start going down the hole. When you're talking too about like what was ancestrally appropriate, that's always kind of what I go back to. Do you consider fasting at all? Like hunter-gatherers back in the day, they might have caught a big animal, might have been 5 days before they did another. Therefore, multi-day fasting is probably good for us as well.
So I do take a different perspective on this as well, slightly. Certainly, throughout human history, there have been times where getting food was difficult. And we can see it in like the teeth, for example, like when teeth are developing, you can see various places where they're nutritionally stressed and which is evident in various teeth marks. However, like you just said, especially like Homo erectus, who's kind of like, I think the work by Dr. Mickey Bendor is just like the best in this area, decimated large megafauna like elephants. So imagine you are in your group of less than 150 people and you're taking down elephants and the land is populated with elephants. Like how often are you going hungry? How often are you not eating to your fill? Because like the biomass of Africa during that time of our evolution was like, there was so many massive fat animals. And if Homo erectus was anything of the hunter that he appears to be, with weapons and like that we can see from the, you know, the fauna and the skeletal remains and the bones, I don't think he was starving all the time, is my perspective. And I think where that may have changed when Homo erectus is kind of, I think, notorious for like decimating a lot of large animals. And so Homo sapiens, which kind of evolved from Homo erectus, we had to catch smaller animals that weren't as fast. And so, you know, maybe then there was times where, hey, there is more fasting. But in general, there's a long answer to someone that's like metabolically like in a bad place, fasting is probably good. Someone that is metabolically healthy is already like you've hey, you've overcome the challenges, right? You probably, I wouldn't be focusing on doing a lot of fasting. I'm like, dude, you got healthy, you lost the weight, you're feeling good. A fast here and there, that's fine, but it's not something I would prescribe regularly, because there's fasting is a stress on the body. Like, the body doesn't want to starve, and some stress is fine, but repeatedly, like, how much is like good versus like, hey, you're just stressing the body for no beneficial reason. And so, yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it. Like,
right,
as a tool to get healthy, but not something I would force people to do, to force themselves to do, for some extra benefit.
Right. No, that makes sense. And when I fasted throughout my life, when I was heavier, it was way easier than now when I'm down more closer to my 100%. Goal weight, get that fat to burn off. So
as it should be, because like, if you're, it's another great topic, but if you think about it, if you're very overweight, you have a huge amount of energy on you in the storm of fat. So if you're not eating, you should be liberating fat, and your body should just be running on that fat. So you should not have the hunger levels as if like you're lean now and you're fasting. The body's like, hey, I don't have as much backup energy. So like fasting, like, it's listening to your body in that regard is not a bad idea.
Yeah. I talk to a lot of people that are doing carnivore, and I always tell them, and this is the truth, I'm kind of jealous of people that still have a bunch of weight. When you're in that period of carnivore and you're in sort of that deep ketosis and you have the fat to burn, it just, I was on autopilot, where sometimes I'm like, I forgot to eat now. I'm not hungry, yep, and I got energy and everything feels great. You start reaping all these benefits. The inflammation starts going down. It's kind of a fun stage of carnivore. I remember when I kind of hit my goal weight, I actually had this period of, I did a video on this where I'm like, I haven't heard some of these good doctors talk about this, but it was almost like my body panicked for a minute. It's like, uh-oh, there's no fat reserves left. And I just got ravenously hungry. I'm like, God, I hope this doesn't last forever, because I don't feel like I can eat this much. And luckily it didn't. And I think I started eating a little bit more fat than I was before, and it kind of normalized after a couple of weeks, but it was kind of a, whoa, this is something weird's happening here moment. It's kind of interesting.
I've experienced similar things.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Yep. Well, one of the other things I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned the gym before, and I know you've done a lot of working out and bodybuilding and things like that. I never exercised until I lost my weight and got healthy. In fact, it always kind of annoys me now in retrospect. When I was 100 pounds heavier than I am now, I was often told, you just got to exercise, you just got to work out. And I was like so sick and fatigued. It's almost like telling someone with pneumonia, like, go walk it off, you'll feel better.
Quick interruption. Thank you so much for watching. If you're interested in learning more about our documentary, Healing Humanity, The Power of a Proper Human Diet, or supporting it, please visit donate.healinghumanity.movie. Our goal is to reach millions of people that are hopeless right now, and sharing the examples of real people over the course of 1 year that are undertaking a proper human diet to overcome obesity, type 2 diabetes, depression, anxiety, fertility issues. We couldn't do it without you. We thank you so much. We are also selling these shirts, Healing Humanity, The Power of a Proper Human Diet. Every penny we get from those goes towards the documentary. And last, we have memberships. If you click the little join button, it's best to do it on desktop, under any one of my YouTube videos, you can join and become a member. We have hundreds of members right now. We do members only videos. We do members only behind the scenes. You can email me as a member and I'll answer you. And every penny from that goes to support the documentary. And the last thing is, we have these Redmond's portable salt shakers. These things are awesome. You can get the best salt. You can take it with you. We sell these on the website, along with our water bottles and cutting boards, and every penny from all of those goes 100% towards supporting the documentary. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which is completely free. All of these links are in the description below.
Thank you so much for your support. Now back to today's video.
But I never really had the desire to actually, I know it's great for you. I never had the desire to, but when I got lost weight and got healthier, metabolically healthier, I just have this urge now. I feel the need. Like my body's like, dude, you're gonna be up all night. You gotta just do this.
You got that energy.
Yeah, I feel better.
You're alive.
I've never gone to the gym. My wife and I, we have triplets plus one. And my whole family, by the way, they're all carnivore, except my one daughter's a little more ketovore. But my girls started going to the gym. This was like 2 weeks ago. And they're like, Dad, you got to go. So I went with them and I started working out. And I'm really enjoying it, although I'm kind of hesitant because we live on a homestead. And I'm like, we could be cutting down a tree and exercising outside. And we're paying this gym to go here. But yeah. I've really been enjoying it. But I guess I was going to ask you, do you have any tips or advice? Like, I want to build muscle. I want to feel better. Is there certain things I should be doing, like protein to fat ratio? Or I told my daughter I was going to be interviewing you, and I was talking about this with her, and she's like, ask him, should she be maxing out? Or are there certain tips? Or complete rookies in the gym, do you have any tips or suggestions?
So this is like a massive topic, and it's one of my favorite things to talk about. And so I like to always start with like, what's the goal? Because if your goal is to like get on stage and compete, you're going to have to do some stuff. Like you're going to have to structure your diet and your workouts a very particular way. If your goal is just like, hey, I want to build some muscle. I want to feel good. I'm not trying to like get on stage or anything. I'm not trying to get like, you know, under 10% body fat where it's like anything crazy. My general recommendation is pretty like simple. It's like, hey, you get on a good workout program, and we can talk about what that might look like. It might be 3 times a week where you're lifting weights, and it's nothing special with your diet. Like if you're already feeling good, then keep on keeping on. The one thing would be is like, hey, I want to put on muscle. Then you eat a little bit more. If you want to lose fat, well, what works for me is like I decrease the fat intake a little bit, increase the protein. So basically, leaner beef, and that does it every time. And depending on how lean I want to get is how far I will, you know, kind of pull that thread. But that's the gist. How old are your triplets?
17, which just blows my mind.
17, man. You seem young.
I am 44.
44. Yeah. Okay. Well, so 17 is, I mean, that's so young. I would at that age, my kind of thing would be is like, I think lifting weights and exercising is good and doing things they enjoy and making it a routine. And I think more so that's important than anything else. Maxing out, there's no need to be maxing out unless you're doing like a powerlifting competition or anything like that at this time. If the goal is like hypertrophy, you know, generally you want to work out in a slightly higher rep range than if you're like strength training. Like, so hypertrophy rep range might be, you know, 7 to 15 reps, where if you're going to train for like powerlifting, then you're like more in the 1 to 5 rep range. And it's not to say like you shouldn't overlap those, but I would say that's kind of some general recommendations. Beyond my number one tip would be, if it's going to become like a lifestyle, which is what it needs to become if you're going to continue it on, it's worth its weight in gold to invest in a personal trainer that knows how to perform lifts correctly. Mm-hmm. And I say that because like I've dealt with all the injuries over the years, and I would be so much further along if I'd have just done things properly from the get-go. And so that's probably my number one recommendation from like a lifting is like, get on a good program, do the exercises correctly, turn it into like a routine, enjoy it, have fun. If you want to get bigger, you need to eat a little bit more, and then something called progressive overload, where you kind of increase the weights over time and or the volume. And if you want to lose weight, it's kind of the opposite for the diet, but the training is still very much the same.
That's great advice. Yeah. We should probably get someone, because I'm kind of, the girls are like, Dad, you're doing that wrong. You're lifting that wrong. I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. Figuring it out, but they've got some trainers there, so that's good. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun just doing it. I think it's become a regular routine now, which is nice. One of the questions I had for you in terms of bodybuilding, I get so many crazy comments on my carnivore videos. I had one guy, actually, I think this was on Facebook. He kept posting over and over again all of these vegan bodybuilders. And so what are your thoughts on that? On bodybuilding, carnivore versus vegan, or just general being an athlete, carnivore versus vegan?
So bodybuilding specifically is it's kind of a shame. I get it. I say people should, you know, generally do whatever they want, but like bodybuilding is littered with people taking anabolic steroids, testosterone, you name it. So you take a vegan with a halfway decent vegan diet plan, meaning like they're doing a bunch of weird stuff just to make sure they're getting adequate protein, and then you start pumping them with testosterone or anabolics, you can look great as a vegan bodybuilder. Your health is probably going to be catering, like just, you know, getting killed. But you can still get like amazing results that way, versus natural athletes, where it's kind of like you got to really optimize things if you want to try and like build a good amount of muscle and stay very, very lean. So I would argue like animal protein is like essential if you want fitness and health. And that's kind of the thing what I come back to is like, if you just want fitness and you're just like, hey, there's something called if it fits your macros. So basically you're like, I don't even care what the food source is. If it fits my calories, my protein, my fat, my carbs, it's fine. Right. So you can eat Pop-Tarts and then, you know, whey protein and whatever, as long as it fits your macros. And when you're young and you have, and you're, it's like kind of new, you can definitely get results that way before your health starts, you know, taking its toll. If you're in it for the long term, which, you know, to really get good results, it takes years and years, you know, you build muscle and such, animal protein needs to be like a part of it, for sure. So yeah, natural vegan bodybuilding is probably, you know, not really a thing, besides if you're really doing, you basically have to do supplements stuff, like, right? So it's not like a very natural vegan whole raw diet. You got to be, I mean, first of all, you got to get like vitamin B12 from other sources anyhow. But yeah, when it comes to performance and health and fitness, like, I would say raw vegan is definitely not the way to go.
Right. Yeah, I think I commented back too. I'm like, the most famous bodybuilder of all time that I know is Arnold. And he was just down in the eggs and the steak back in the day, yeah. Anyways, when he was building his body. So, oh, this has been great, Dr. Sock. So I have one more question for you. We're doing this documentary, Healing Humanity, and we're asking everybody, does humanity need healing from your perspective?
Does humanity need healing? Absolutely. And I'll just speak to like the dentistry, my profession is, as we talked about, cavities are the most common disease in the world. Like that right there should be, and the effect that cavities have and tooth loss and periodontal disease on the quality of one's life is very significant. And that's not even to talk about like the sequela of disease that which is making an unhealthy mouth is also making an unhealthy body. And I don't think that should shock too many people. And by a lot of metrics, our health has been declining for decades now. You can look at obesity rates, which, you know, we are now at the point where in the United States, 70% of people are overweight or obese, and we're projected to be 50% of the population by the end of the decade. And you can just look at what that means for sleep apnea and all the comorbidities that are associated with just those two things alone, sleep apnea and obesity. You'd say, yeah, we need to turn the ship around. We need to like right this. So I would say humanity does need healing. And I would argue that meat can and should play a central role in both healing, you know, the human as well as the planet and the soils that we touched on today. Like ruminants play a very important role in regenerating soils, and that also is needed if humanity is to stay healed for, you know, the long run.
Right. Awesome. Great stuff, Dr. Sock. I really appreciate it. This has been great. Where can people find you and learn more about what you're doing and follow you?
Sure. So I run a website called meat.health. And there's all kinds of resources on, you know, doing a carnivore diet, like a 30-day guide to starting carnivore. There's health dangers of a plant-based diet, which these are just, it's a free ebook on some of the plant toxins we talked about today. Like, why should we limit certain plants? There's also a free ebook on carnivore fat loss. So a lot of people come to carnivore for fat loss. And if that is you, then there's some important things to consider up front, because some people will gain weight initially, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. You just need to be prepared. So those three kind of ebooks are free at meat.health. And I write a weekly newsletter called The Saturday Seven. If someone's interested, I just put my best stuff from the week in that newsletter. And my website's kevinstock.io if someone wants to sign up for the newsletter.
Awesome. I will have links in the description for all of that. Really appreciate your time. This has been really fascinating. Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
Talk to you later. Bye.